The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. About 20 years ago, I had a visit here in Yellow Springs from an Irish writer. She had just published her first book. It was a memoir called I Am Somebody. Her name was Nuala O'Fallon. Nuala went on to publish several novels after that, and she became one of my favorite guests. We did several interviews. And the second time I interviewed her was for her first novel. It was called My Dream of You. Here's Nuala O'Fallon from the Best of the Book Nook. Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. And it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Nuala O'Fallon. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, and congratulations on your O'Fallon pronunciation.
Oh, wow. Did I do that okay?
You did that wonderfully. And they can't pronounce that even at home in Ireland.
Well, it's my pleasure to have you back here.
So thank you.
I would hate to, you know, abuse your name since I'm so thrilled to have you back.
I love the way Americans go for it, you know, because, like, this country's full of people called Brzezinski and Olujulu and all. So everybody will try a name, but in England they don't. They just throw up their hands as if it's your own fault if you've got a name they can't pronounce.
Well, Nuala, I was particularly delighted to hear that you had written this novel and that you were going to come back into the Dayton area because, frankly, when I talked to you last time with your memoir, Are You Somebody?, as you left the studio, I said to myself, I'll probably never see her again. And what a wonderful experience that was. And now here you are again.
Oh, thank you. But to tell you the truth, I remembered that interview as, I don't know what about it, but it struck a kind of level of mutual understanding, Vic, that is, in fact, very rare. And I have remembered it always. So I'm even more pleased, though I must say I'm very surprised to be back, because at that stage I didn't think of myself, of course, as a writer or as somebody who'd ever write anything.
I remember when you talked about the genesis of the memoir. Initially, you were just submitting some columns from the Irish Times, and you were asked to write an introduction, and then it turned into your story.
That's exactly so. I mean, nobody ever asked me to write a memoir, and if I had gone round the publishing houses offering to do it, nobody would have said yes. It was as much a fluke, really, as if you were to go out into the street or the shopping mall and stop a woman and middle-aged woman and say, excuse me, would you like to write your life story? But I did and do have a job as a columnist with an Irish newspaper called the Irish Times. And a small publishing house was collecting some of my old opinion columns, which was a completely pointless thing to do because nobody in their right mind reads old opinion columns. And because I was ashamed of, you know, the sheer bookmaking side of it, I said, I'll write an introduction, you know, so that there'll be something new in the book. And I found that the only introduction I could write would be an autobiographical one. And I let it rip. I said everything I wanted to say because I was convinced that nobody'd ever really read it, except whatever handful of lunatics wanted to read old opinion columns. So I both took advantage of publication and yet felt I was sheltered, if you see what I mean. And I'm sure many people would equally have to sort of cheat their way into talking about themselves like that.
Well, I'm so glad we had that memoir to read because it really holds a lot of the keys, I think, to a better understanding of your novel.
That's true, yeah. And I don't think many people see that.
Well, as I was reading it, I kept thinking about your life and the things you talked about, and also our interview, because we got into some other areas.
We did, yes.
In fact, when you left at the time, I thought, you know, she doesn't really seem that excited about what's happening to her with this memoir. She seems almost defeated. Is that correct assessment?
I think that's incredibly insightful of you. I almost took it as part of the general melancholy and bad luck of my life. I was so used to enduring bad things that I did to myself and that life did to me, that it took me a long time to simply and joyfully recognize that the success of Are You Somebody, particularly outside my own culture, its success here in the United States, was an absolutely amazing miracle to happen to me in middle life. And that I simply couldn't go on with my moaning about being alone and unloved and so on, when it was perfectly obvious that, though I was still alone, that many strangers were willing to extend loving thoughts to me and the hand of friendship. And I know that because of letters I got, and I know that because of the people I met at readings. And it took me a long while to train myself out of my habit of looking on the dark side. And I think that though the novel has the same themes in part as the memoir, it's much more optimistic, I think, and youthful than the memoir was.
I remember something that Kathleen DeBurka's mother said, and it was something along the lines of, love? Who finds love? Or I'm just paraphrasing this.
Oh, I remember the line you mean. Kathleen has a lovely uncle and an old chap who cycles in on a bicycle and helps out the family and everything. This is in rural Ireland in the 1960s. And one day Kathleen says to her mother, was Uncle Ned ever in love? And the mother says bitterly, love? Nobody around here was ever in love.
And it's kind of that dark vision that you are getting out of. You sound wonderful.
Thank you. Mind you, I'm getting older all the time, which is a bit of a regret. I mean, why did all my breaks come in my 50s, you know? I do regret that I couldn't, if I was going to be this lucky, I wish I could have been this lucky when I was 30. And above all about writing, I mean, the memoir was meant, well, I didn't think of it as writing at all. I was just telling my story. But this novel is writing, and it's my first piece of writing, my first fiction. And I'm very old, you know, to be starting an apprenticeship. So on the one hand, I'm thrilled by what can happen in life, even when you think that all the main things are over. And on the other hand, I can't help but regret that it all didn't happen sooner.
My guest is Nuala O'Faoilán. My Dream of You is the name of it. Tell us how this novel came about.
Well, I took it into my head to write a novel. Again, nobody had asked me to or offered me money, and I'd no agent or anything like that. But it seemed to me that life had opened up the possibility for me, after the success of the memoir, of being a writer, that it was maybe something I could do. So I was sitting in this little cottage I live in the west of Ireland with my dog, and I was trying to get myself started. But I kept thinking of reasons why I couldn't write a novel, mainly that if I could write a novel, I'd have done it long ago, you know, that I wouldn't just be starting now. And after a long time of making up reasons not to start, I thought, in America, they don't think like that. In America, they don't, you know, get their excuses in first, or they don't apologize for trying to do things. In the United States, there's a culture that says, listen, go for it, you know, enjoy it, have a go. What does it matter if you fail? So the first thing I did to write this novel was I left Ireland. I got leave of absence from my job at the newspaper. I put the little dog on a farm where she's perfectly happy, and I moved to Manhattan, just me and my laptop. I got a room there. I got a cat out of a shelter. And I sat there effectively for a year and three quarters and wrote this novel. And I wrote it in the atmosphere of transformation that I associate with America. It's a great immigrant country. It's full of people who either they or their forebears came here to change themselves. And that's what I was trying to do, to change myself. So that's the ambience that I began with.
That's an amazing story. I had no idea that you went to Manhattan and locked yourself up in a garret with your friend the cat to do
this. Yes, I was extremely happy because it worked for me. If I went out just to the supermarket for a few messages, you know, or if I went down Broadway to buy an Irish newspaper or anything, I came back to my room re-energized in a way that couldn't have happened in my quiet little lane in the west of Ireland. I really respond to the sweetness and the hope that there is at its best in North American culture. And I needed it. It was the oxygen I was living on. I didn't know how to write a novel, don't forget. But I had an idea. I had always had a document about an old divorce case that really did happen in Ireland in the middle of the 19th century, called the Talbot Divorce, where a big landlord, a big Anglo-Irish, Englishy type landlord, because, of course, the English had conquered Ireland and the English owned all the land. We were just workers on the land, we Irish. Anyway, his wife was alleged to have had a passionate affair with a servant, an Irish servant, on their estate. And I had always been interested in that for two reasons. One was because I'd never heard of the ruling classes having anything personal to do with one of us, the native Irish, in all the hundreds of years that they were on top. And secondly, I was interested in the time it happened, because this affair was said to have started in 1849, when Ireland was reeling after year of a potato famine, which had led to half the population in a few years, either dying in the most dreadful way of starvation or disease, or else getting somehow to the ports to get on a boat to get here to America. So the 1840s are a terrible decade in Irish history. And it intrigued me that two young people in 1849 in this devastated country could reach for each other and would reach for each other across every possible barrier. So I had that historic document and I began from that.
And they were really violating every norm of their society. They were forbidden to be together. In fact, she was married.
She was married and a mother, but above all, she was the landlord's wife. She was supposed to be so far above the servants. I mean, the famines revealed how often English people looked on, particularly the poor Irish, as almost as animals, certainly not as full human beings. So for a lady to mate with one of them, to them was absolutely shocking. And indeed, she was put into a lunatic asylum because it was assumed that she must be a lunatic if she did it.
And these biases die hard, don't they? You make the point of the placard in the book. I think it says, no blacks, no Irish, no dogs.
Well, when I used to go to England to work in the late 1950s, I didn't see exactly that placard, but I often saw rooms to let, but on the bottom would be no Irish, because the Irish, as far as the English were concerned, were just troublesome tinkers, you know, even respectable little girls like me who were working as maids and scrubbing floors and all that. No Irish, you'd see, no Irish, no Irish. And eventually I got myself into the middle class and I had middle class jobs in England. But in my view, it's very difficult for English people not to condescend to the Irish. You know, even when they're trying to be nice, they're condescending. Mm. You know, they say, oh, you talk, you know, oh, I really like your accent. Do say that again. Are they some little remark that makes you see that they don't take you seriously?
My guest is Nuala O'Fallon. Her first novel has just come out. It's called My Dream of You. Clearly, it's fiction, Nuala, but having spoken with you about your memoir, as I read the book, I kept seeing elements of your life in whatever form coming through. You have the description of your travel writer, Kathleen DeBurka, leaving her flat and the whole situation with the landlord.
Oh, yeah.
One feels a certain degree of pleasure as a reader when she writes out that check for £50.
Well, yeah, but I hesitated about putting that scene in the book because it is a very upsetting scene. But I'm talking there about my heroine's misery. That's her lowest point. I think I should explain to our readers that the historical bit is only a small bit of my dream of you. What I worked out in the end was I have a modern story about a modern woman who admittedly at the beginning is much like myself. She's 50, she's a travel writer, but she has quite a glamorous life and very few responsibilities because she lives in an apartment in London. She hasn't been back to Ireland for 30 years, and she travels all the time. But in fact, her life has gone wrong long since, and she's got no close friends except her pal at work, Jimmy. She's got no feeling of community because she feels an outsider as an Irish person in England. She has no loving, sensual relationship. Her sensual life has boiled down to the occasional quickie in a business hotel somewhere where she's spending a couple of nights and whoever he is spending a couple of nights. And even as a travel writer, she's beginning to worry about all the cheery little articles she writes from countries that are very unjust and where there is terrible suffering. So she's managed to get her life wrong and she knows it. And then a very important thing happens in that completely unexpectedly, her friend Jimmy dies. And that starts off a series of crises that in the end send her back to Ireland. And she goes back to Ireland to write a book, if she can, about the historical event, the divorce I've just been telling you about. And she goes back to do that. And My Dream of You is an account of her journey back to Ireland, her first journey back in 30 years. And in that journey, an awful lot happens to her. And I believe that in it she reclaims her real self, herself as a woman, and also through finding out about this old love affair that happened at the end of the decade of the famine, she reclaims herself as an Irish woman. So that's what My Dream of You is about.
And your character, Jimmy, from Scottsbluff, Nebraska, a gay man who goes to London and becomes a travel writer and is a close colleague of your narrator, your protagonist, Kathleen DeBurka. He is such a wonderful character.
Isn't he?
Even though he dies, he's still alive in the book.
I know, because, of course, he's always in her memory. And so are his parents. And the little house in Scottsbluff, Nebraska, where the four of them used to have Christmas, you know, looking at the television and wearing their little slippers with Santa Claus on in fluorescent red. And actually, they're like a family for her, Jimmy and his mother and father. I've never been to Scottsbluff, Nebraska, but when I was a girl, I had an American boyfriend for a while, and he invited me to come back with him to Scottsbluff, Nebraska, so I could be a Nebraskan housewife rather than an itinerant Irish writer.
Oh, if there but for the grace of God.
Well, who knows which life would have been happier. One of the reasons I have loved starting to become a fiction writer is I love the way it allows you to lead more lives than you've led yourself.
Nuala, if I had to pick a plot point that I think is the most compelling about the book, it's the story of our existence on this planet, our search for passion, our search for love. I think that you have a quote in the book that captures this very well, where you say, "I believe that the body was the way to the heart, and the heart was the way to the soul."
Yes. You know, I never know why people talk about, oh, such and such relationship was only physical, you know? Or you hear people say they had a great physical relationship, but otherwise they didn't communicate. But I think that physical love is a form of speech. It's a form of allowing yourself to be known, as well as a form of learning. This, incidentally, is what I have against a celibate church like our Irish Roman Catholic Church, or, well, the Roman Catholic Church. It's not so much that I believe that, you know, priests know nothing about sex. They do know loads about sex from their human experience, but it's that they haven't taken the risk on being known, which is what people do risk when they make love. And I think that that phrase, making love, actually is entirely descriptive, that at best, anyway, when a man and a woman, or a woman and a woman, a man and a man, make love, they're making love. They're making the thing called love grow between them. Now, these may seem very way-out ideas, but I don't see why all this stuff about sex should be put down all the time. I think it's much more important in most people's lives than they ever admit.
There's almost a repression in Ireland of that side of life.
It's not just Ireland that is conflicted and repressed about these matters. It seems to me that more or less everywhere is, because we're always in a conflict between civilization and our animal selves. But one of the themes of my book is that we are animals. We do need to touch and be touched. And we learn each other through bodies if we can. And when someone like Kathleen completely misuses her body by just, you know, going to bed with strangers once in a blue moon, that's not learning, and it's bad for you.
And Kathleen goes through a tremendous transformation through the novel. I don't know how much you want to get into that. We might want to leave that as a mystery to our readers.
But she does meet a man herself when she goes back to Ireland. And it is that impels her to start writing a book about the historical divorce case.
I love the way you wrote this book. How long did it take you to get it all done and be happy with the result?
It took a year and three quarters, but the thing about that time was that the first year and a half was sheer slog, and I was completely out of my depth. I couldn't manage all my plots. I wrote far more than there is there, and I didn't know how to cut it. I also, somehow or other, I didn't really control my laptop. I didn't know what file anything was in. You know what I mean? I used to wake up in the morning in my little room in Manhattan in the dark, because it was the winter both times I was there, and I'd put a nightie on over my nightdress, I mean a sweater on, and I'd sit over at the laptop. And I often cried beginning the day's work because it was just like shoveling mud. And then, and this was a real miracle, I had never believed that hard work does pay off, but it does. And after a year and a half of doing nothing but sticking it out, one morning, that was exactly like every other morning, I sat down and suddenly my material moved for me, and I began to see, oh, look, if I change that to that and cut that. And, you know, so the last quarter of a year was a great pleasure as I sort of bet it into shape.
When that moment occurred where you had that sense of clarity, was there any sign? Was there something that happened in your life, something that...
I've wondered about that because, of course, if I knew how to get it again, I would. I had put together a rough draft of the book for the first time, a really incomplete one, and I'd sent it to my elder sister. Now, I don't even like her, and she doesn't like me either. But we have known each other all our lives, and it may be that she is some kind of reality check to me, that it distanced the book from me to send it to her. Do you know what I mean? It may be that I managed to stand back from it just a tiny bit. Whatever happened anyway, it was a total miracle. It was a wonderful day when I began to move with ease around my own material.
Did you feel like she would be someone who would be freely critical?
Oh, yeah, of course, and she was. But I have no real regard for her opinions, and I didn't incorporate any of her suggestions. But the act of putting it together to send to her, which I did as a kindness to her, because she was going on a holiday to a very boring, hot place, and she wanted something to read. And I thought, well, this will interest her more than anything. And that's why I put it together.
Mm.
And look how it paid off.
I should say, what are some of the wild questions that you've been asked?
Oh, God. I'm constantly asked questions about Irish politics, you know, which has very, in my books, there isn't any Irish politics, really.
Uh-huh.
But you find people who want to talk to me about how can the problem in the north of Ireland be fixed, or else they give their view on how the problem in the north of Ireland can be fixed. Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Or I get people, sometimes you get fairly wacky things. Like, I was in Chicago the other day, and a woman kept jumping up and saying, what you need is yoga. And, you see, it's a kindly impulse, but it kind of screws everything up. So it's always a little bit iffy, what will people say? And will one person try to keep on talking and not let anybody else in? You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
But in general, I mean, book readers in this country are marvelous people. They're serious people, you know, and they can talk.
Nuala, I've been admiring the picture on the cover of the book, the attitude, the pose of this woman. I'm guessing this must be Lady Talbot.
Well, actually, it could be any woman. It's about a woman really in the throes of either dreaming or passion. But it is, in fact, a painting by Goya that's in the National Gallery of Ireland.
Well, it's just absolutely splendid.
Isn't it beautiful, yeah?
Yes. Really, it is. I'm so pleased that we had an opportunity to talk about your novel.
Well, it's a great pleasure. I'm so pleased that we've come across each other again. And I want to thank you for having read it, because many an interviewer simply doesn't. And I don't blame those interviewers, but it's so wonderful to have somebody to really talk to.
Well, Nuala, I found that the key to a good conversation is to actually be able to talk about something.
Yeah, but that means that, like me, when I wrote it, you put the work in too. Work pays off.
Well, it's a labor of love to read books like this.
Gosh, thank you.
The book is My Dream of You. My guest has been Nuala O'Fuilleann.
Thank you, Vic. Thanks very much indeed.
If you could stay on the line, you've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. Stay tuned. You have been listening to the best of The Book Nook on WYSO, going back about 17 years for that interview with Nuala O'Fuilleann for her first novel, My Dream of You. And I remember the last time I interviewed Nuala, she came out here to the station, and we had a really wonderful conversation. She signed my book, and then I went out to the driveway and watched her drive away, and she looked at me, and she gave me kind of a funny look, and I thought, I hope I see her again. Well, I never did. And then when I went back into the studio to look for the book, it was gone. She'd taken it with her by accident. I never got that book back. I loved her. She had such a wonderful attitude, and I really miss her. Nuala died in 2008. For the best of The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.